installation of fluid back into the uterus intrapartum is not unusual. I mean, we do amnio infusion, right? The main indication for amnio infusion, of course, is the relief of umbilical cord compression so that variable D cells can improve as a way to keep C-sections away. It's not unusual to do amnio infusion. We're going to talk about that in this episode. But here's a clinical conundrum. What happens if your patient qualifies for amnio infusion because of recurrent variable D cells, but she has a pre-existing diagnosis intrapartum of suspected chorioamnionitis, intraamniotic infection? Here's the question. Does that patient still qualify for amnio infusion, or do you say, oh, nope, she's got infection. I mean, we can't put fluid up in her uterus because potentially we can disseminate that and make her even sicker. Is that a thing? Or is it totally acceptable to use amnio infusion in a patient with a suspected chorioamnionitis still for the relief of variable cord compression? So which is it? Is suspected IAI, intraamniotic infection, a contraindication to otherwise necessary amnio infusion? We're going to talk about it in this episode. And as I've mentioned before, if you think, well, that's just easy, we'll just go to the bulletin on amnio infusion. It's not in there because there is no bulletin on amnio infusion, but there is several on management of intrapartum fetal heart rate abnormalities where amnio infusion is described, just as we've discussed, as a way to relieve umbilical cord compression. But you've got to go beyond that indication into the data itself to see if amnio infusion makes patients sicker when they have IAI, or if it's neutral, or in some reports, even potentially makes them better. It's kind of a neat clinical question, and it may happen to you. It's happened to us. So I thought, you know what? Let's get this topic out. We're going to cover amnio infusion in the presence of IAI. Yay or nay? Let's cover that now. Just trying to keep everyone up to date on evidence-based practice because medicine moves real fast. This is Clinical Pearls. Well, I think this is an interesting clinical conundrum. You may not. I don't know. I've got a lot of responses. I asked for feedback whether I should do this topic or not. And the response that I got is, you know, I never really thought about that. It's a good question. And then I had some responses on our social media platform, some messages that came to me that said, I think, isn't that going to make the patient sicker? I mean, if we disseminate infection, it's otherwise localized in the chorioamnion. But if we do amnio infusion, does that somehow make the patient more ill? That's a good question. I mean, that's a thought, right? But remember, if she's ruptured, typically she's ruptured in the area of the cervix, although you can have a high cervical leak. So if you put fluid into the uterus, it's still pretty contained, right? So, I mean, it's not like it's technically coming out of the tubes, although that's possible, but the baby's still in the intact chorioamnion throughout the body of the uterus. Typically, amniorexis, rupture of the bag of water, happens at the level of the cervix. So it's not that it's going to distill that bacteria into the abdominal cavity, although potentially that's possible. So that was one of the concerns. Other people sent me messages and said, hey, I thought that actually could improve them and potentially decrease temperature because you're putting at least room temperature fluid into the uterine cavity to try to bring down fever. Now, remember, not cold flu. We're not trying to give the baby hypothermia, and we're not trying to decrease temperature by giving the mother some kind of intracorporeal cold fluid therapy, even though the temperature can drop a little bit, even with room temperature fluid. So these are all good questions. These are all good points, and there's answers for all of this, all right? So, and we're going to tackle all of this. So the first question is, if there's suspected intraamniotic infection. And remember, we say suspected because unless you actually tap the amniotic fluid and do a Gram stain or look for interleukin 6, we don't really know. It's typically made after delivery because the term chorioamnionitis is inflammation of the chorioamnion. And the only way you know that is with histological examination. I mean, that's ACOG's whole bulletin on management of intrapartum infection, which is, you know, we think it's chorioamnionitis. That's why we call it suspected intraamniotic infection, okay? And we've covered that many, many times on this channel. But the whole take-home message is, if you have a patient who's intrapartum and she meets clinical criteria for IAI, or if you want to call it chorioamnionitis, that's fine. Or if you want to call it the triple I, which is intrauterine inflammation and infection, all of those are the same thing, okay? The most comprehensive, the most technically correct is triple I, right? Because it's intrauterine infection and inflammation. Chorioamnionitis, again, is a pathological term. And then the term intraamniotic infection is fine, but it takes away that importance that it's the inflammation that potentially is harmful to the child. So anyway, triple I is the most technically correct, although all of them can be interchanged one by the other. All to say, this is a clinical conundrum. If a patient has first diagnosis of suspected triple I, and then goes through labor, and she develops variable D cells. You go, oh, great. Well, yeah, I was going to give her amnioinfusion, but now I'm afraid because she's infected. Is that an issue? And is that safe? We're going to talk about that in this episode. And of course, remember that as a standalone diagnosis, triple I or IAI or whatever you want to call it, is not an indication for C-section. It's an indication for administration of appropriate antibiotics. I mean, that mother needs antibiotic coverage, even in the cases of isolated maternal fever. Again, we've talked about that on this channel on various occasions, okay? Because you have no way of knowing if it's isolated maternal temperature or if it's true brewing intraamniotic infection. So you just treat it empirically. And the same goes for epidural-related fever, right? Yes, it's possible that the neuraxial blockade, because of the changes in catecholamine levels, could trigger as a parasympathectomy a little temperature elevation. The problem is you have no way of proving that that's that versus triple I, so you treat them empirically as well. So if you're calling it, oh, it's epidural-related fever or just isolated maternal temperature, just treat them. You don't know if they're going to decompensate. And until we have a way to actually stratify and actually diagnose who is just isolated maternal fever from an epidural versus true triple I, you got to treat them all the same. We have covered that many times on this show, so you got to go back and listen to that archive. However, chorioamnionitis, even though that's not an indication for C-section, the fetal response to chorioamnionitis may be. In other words, if there's persistent category 2 tracing because of the reflex tachycardia that the child gets, whether it's because of early signs of infection or just because the baby gets hot, right? I mean, inside the core temperature of the mother, it's hot in there. And so as the baby gets increased hyperthermia, has increased temperature, baby's heart rate rises. So that's one of the catches. You don't know if it's heart rate rising because the baby's just hot or if it's getting infected. So if it's persistent tachycardia, which is under the category 2 tracing, persistent fetal tachycardia may be an indication for C-section if it doesn't come down. That's why you've got to lower the maternal temperature. That's why you have to give IV fluid resuscitation. That's why you give appropriate antibiotics to see if it responds. Because the baby at 180, for more than 30 minutes, can go through high output cardiac failure. I mean, that's a risk for poor neonatal outcome. So persistent fetal tachycardia, and even there's mild tachycardia and severe tachycardia, that's not related to a fetal arrhythmia, that could be an indication for C-section. So that's always a nice oral board question, right? Is chorioamnionitis an indication for C-section? No, of course not. It's an indication for intrauterine resuscitation and appropriate use of medication, including antibiotics. However, the fetal response to that condition indeed could be a C-section, an indication for C-section, all right? So this is the clinical conundrum that we're talking about. Patient has suspected IAI, and now you put her into labor. Her, okay, temperature has come down. Baby's non-tachycardic. But intrapartum, boom, there you have it. Starts getting recurrent variable D cells. And there's no evidence of cord prolapse. Y'all get the scenario? Pretty real world, right? I mean, it happens. And so your resident asks you, hey, can we go ahead and do an amnio infusion? And then you say, wait, isn't that our patient with IAI? And they go, yes. And you say, what? That's our topic here, because there's only really two camps, right? Those that are afraid to do it because, you can't do it. She's infected. Can't do that, man. I mean, you're going to make her sicker. Are you, though? Are you? The answer is no. And so there's a spoiler. And then the other camp, which is, well, of course, give her amnio infusion. The value of preventing recurrent umbilical cord compression, the value is still there, because we know without a doubt that clamping on the cord, blocking his oxygen supply repetitively over time is not good. That's how you build up to metabolic acidosis in the child. And the theoretical risk of making the patient sicker because she's infected is just not there. So let me give you the data. We're going to walk through this. I think it's pretty fascinating here, because it all kind of goes down to the old premise of microbiology. Remember the principles of surgical site infection? Why do we irrigate a wound? Why do we do sub-Q pouring of saline before we close the wound, right? At least once to try to decrease bacterial contamination. Because the old adage in microbiology and in surgical site infections, of course, is the secret to pollution is dilution. Y'all remember that? Or was that just a Texas thing? Okay, because I learned that at Parkland in medical school. And then in residency, the secret to pollution is dilution. So if there's bacterial contamination somewhere, obviously if there's gross contamination with a class 3 surgical incision or a class 4, you got to irrigate. You got to wash that stuff out. That's why you do pelvic washings, to try to irrigate some of that contamination out. So that's that premise here, that if the intrauterine cavity is infected, put fluid in it and have it leak out. You're basically flushing the uterus, so to speak. And that's been looked at. Now, to be very clear, in no way am I promoting, everybody listen, I am not promoting intra-amniotic infusion, amnio infusion, as a way to treat chorio. That is not what I'm talking about. Even though some have proposed that, and even though there's a Cochrane systematic review that has looked at that, which we're going to get into. So I'll be very clear, I am not proposing a treatment of suspected IAI to be amnio infusion. You're going to do an amnio infusion because there is the standard indication for it, the without doubt indication, which is recurrent variable D cells. Okay. And that's a second line therapy. The first line therapy is possibly reducing uterine contraction frequency, changing sides, checking for umbilical cord prolapse. That's the primary. Okay. And IV fluid bolus to increase of volume and pressure head going to the placenta. That's first line. Second line is amnio infusion for variable D cells. Okay. That's an ACOG thing. Everybody agrees that. And I am not promoting amnio infusion to treat IAI. The question, of course, is can you do amnio infusion if the patient happens to have IAI? All right, so we want to be very clear, because I don't want to get in trouble and somebody misinterpret this. Now, let's talk about indications very quickly, because as I mentioned, the sine qua non, the without doubt option, barring an umbilical cord prolapse, for amnio infusion is recurrent variable D cells. That is the tradition intrapartum where amnio infusion is done transcervically. And there's different protocols. You can do one-time bolus. You can do a bolus and continuous infusion. You can skip the bolus and just do continuous infusion through the IUPC. You do you. Okay, not one has been known to be better than the other. We just know that putting fluid back helps prevent uterine compression of the umbilical cord against the child, assuming that the variables are not because of a nuchal cord. Because if there's a double nuchal cord and that's what's causing the variables, that don't care if you do an amnio infusion. That's not going to give you any kind of cushion there. So people have said, well, I'm only going to do an amnio infusion if I do an ultrasound and I see loops of cord around the neck. Fantastic. That's a great academic discussion. But just because you see cord around the neck doesn't mean that there's not cord around the body getting compressed either. Because just because it's nuchal cord doesn't mean that that absolutely is the cause of the variable. It's highly likely, but that could also be a cord compression from the body somewhere. So nuchal cord is not a contraindication to amnioinfusion. You still try. That's a prognostic issue. That's where you tell the patient, hey, look, I did an ultrasound. I see a loop of cord around the neck. That's not an indication for C-section either, but I'm going to try to rescue the child by putting fluid back. And if that doesn't work, then we can always just go to plan B, which is doing a delivery through the sunroof, okay? The sunroof being the abdomen. So that's what we can choose. So if you do an amnioinfusion, you may not be as successful with a nuchal cord, but a nuchal cord is not a contraindication to amnioinfusion. All right, everybody good. So that's the first, the most traditional, non-controversial indication for amnioinfusion, and the college says that's a way to treat persistent category 2 due to variable D cells, is transcervical amnioinfusion. The more controversial one has to do with meconium. Because if you go back to ACOG's original committee opinion back in 2006, y'all remember way back then? Okay, 2006, in October, this is ACOG's past committee opinion number 346. 346. This was the committee opinion with the title, quote, amnioinfusion does not prevent meconium aspiration syndrome, end quote. Well, that's kind of the whole message. Again, I hate when studies or committee opinions put what it's trying to tell you in the title, because then people just read the title and go, okay, cool. Well, I guess I'm done. And that's fine. That's the message of committee opinion 346 from the Green Journal in 2006. But you got to go in there and look at all the data, look at all the little stuff and all the seasonings to the meal, and take a look at all the little pieces that are on the plate. But if you just want to just eat it all in one swap by just reading the title, fantastic. And that's exactly what committee opinion 346 title is. Amnioinfusion does not prevent meconium aspiration syndrome. Now, if you're thinking, well, wait a minute, was that a thing once? Absolutely, because I trained with that. We'd break a bag of water, or she'd have spontaneous amniorexis. And we're like, oh, there's MEC. Hey, let's put in an IUPC and let's dilute that so it becomes less particulate, so that there's less chance of thick blockages into the child as a way to prevent meconium aspiration syndrome, MAS. So I trained with that. And then in 2006, we're like, oh, wait a minute. That's actually dissolving it into the fluid, and the baby's gasping liquid all the time in utero, so it may not prevent MAS, and in some cases may actually cause it by making it much more available to swallow. So ACOG said, look, we're just not comfortable with this. I know it was a thing for meconium, but let's go ahead and stop it. So that stopped in 2006. Okay, so that was the traditional. However, things are changing. Things have changed. And you remember, I have an episode on this. When this next piece that I'm about to tell you came out from the Gray Journal, the American Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology, in May of 2023, guys, just 1 year ago, the systematic review and meta-analysis that looked at amnioinfusion for MAS, and the data, according to this publication, was, hey, man, we should be doing this. I mean, this actually helps prevent meconium aspiration syndrome if it's moderate to up to thick meconium. Thick meconium, like real pea-like soup, that's probably, you got other issues going on there, and that's not going to help. But the data showed that in those with moderate up to thick meconium, it did seem, amnioinfusion seemed to reduce the propensity to develop MAS. This paper from the Gray Journal, again from May 2023, has some big name players in here, right? So you've got Sanchez Ramos, a staple in OBGYN literature, and somebody who I've talked about as well in other publications is Dr. Connitz, okay, Andrew Connitz. Just fantastic leaders, and I look up to Dr. Connitz because I think he just does great work. But they did this systematic review and meta-analysis that used a total of 24 randomized studies, right? So these aren't retrospective. These aren't math models. These are 24 RCTs, had close to 6,000 participants. And here's what they found, quote, the overall odds of meconium aspiration syndrome was reduced by 67% in the amnioinfusion group, showing a net benefit over 50%. So 67% had benefit with amnioinfusion, in direct contrast and indirect opposition to ACOG's committee opinion 346 back in 2006. All right, is that crazy or what? This is just last year. Now, there is a catch to this, because they said, quote, except for postpartum endometritis, amnioinfusion was associated with a significant reduction in all secondary outcomes, end quote. And this is the one thing. So while we get good news from this systematic review and meta-analysis that, hey, amnioinfusion can maybe potentially reduce MAS at the trade-off of postpartum endometritis. And that's a controversial part. See, nothing is free. We get good news and then we throw in another piece of controversy, because the increased rate of postpartum endometritis is super conflicting and super controversial. There is not a predominance of evidence that has shown that amnioinfusion increases postpartum metritis. Some have shown that, others have not. Others have shown that with active intraamniotic infection or suspected IAI, amnioinfusion actually reduces the rate of postpartum endometritis. So I don't want anybody to have a fear of amnioinfusion because of, oh, maybe we'll give her postpartum endometritis. Well, you can treat that. It's harder to get rid of metabolic acidosis in the child, which can have long-term neurodevelopmental issues. You get what I'm saying? So even if there's a true known risk of postpartum endometritis, which we don't know, that's controversial, because of amnioinfusion, I'll gladly take that, because I can get on top of that and give antibiotics postpartum if I have to. The net benefit is still there. But the point I'm trying to make here is, while nobody questions the use of amnioinfusion for variable D cells, the question is, can you do an amnioinfusion for meconium? And the answer is, well, that depends on who you read. The official, the last ACOG stance on this was in 2006 from the Green Journal. And then we have this new meta-analysis from May of 2023, which says that, hey, 67% reduction of MAS is something to be considered. So I'll leave it at that. To be complete, ACOG's other committee opinion dealing with meconium stained amniotic fluid was committee opinion number 689, okay? That's from March of 2017. The title of that committee opinion, which has nothing to do with amnioinfusion, I'm just trying to be complete here, guys, is delivery of a newborn with meconium stained amniotic fluid, right? Not that long ago, 2017. And this was the bulletin that changed also the routine issue that we got to suction real good at the perineum, got to get all that meconium out. Now, if it swallowed meconium, it's going to do that in utero. So ACOG made the following recommendations back in this committee opinion, stating, quote, infants with meconium-stained amniotic fluid, regardless of whether they are vigorous or not, listen to that, should no longer routinely receive intrapartum suctioning. However, meconium-stained amniotic fluid is a condition that requires notification of the appropriately credentialed team with full resuscitation ability, including endotracheal intubation for the child, right? So no more delay at the perineum. You don't have to put the bulb suction in there and suck stuff out. Just do your routine evaluation, right? Whether they are vigorous or not. So that was the big change in this committee opinion. Again, it has nothing to do with amnioinfusion, just trying to be thorough here in our coverage of this topic. And ACOG continues to say in this committee opinion, quote, if the infant born through meconium-stained amniotic fluid presents with poor muscle tone and inadequate breathing, the initial steps of resuscitation should be completed under the radiant warmer, period. It doesn't say, oh my gosh, go ahead and delete first and get stuff out. No, go take it to the warmer and do your appropriate interventions to help support ventilation and oxygenation, just like every other child, right? And if the airway seems to be obstructed, then that can include intubationing and suction. So no more blind sticking things into the nose with a little trap like the DLE, like how I trained. If you have no idea what a delayed suction is, man, you're missing out, right? So you put it into the nose, it was connected to wall suction, and there was a little catch that would take the meconium in there, because sometimes you could send that for study. Yeah, that was useless. So we don't do that anymore. And if you suspect that there's a block, don't be sticking things in there blind because you're pushing it further down in there. Intubate, take a look, and then do suctioning that way if necessary, all right? So intubation is required for establishment of the airway, and then suction may be done with that approach. As we get ready to leave this little sidetrack here on delivery of a newborn with meconium-stained amniotic fluid, because we're supposed to be talking about amnioinfusion in the presence of IAI, but this is good stuff. And it just has to be said so that we cover all the points here for medical education that we have to do. ACOG makes the final stance here where it says, quote, "The new recommendation to no longer routinely suction non-vigorous infants arose from an emphasis on prevention of harm, that is, delays in providing bag mask ventilation and potential consequences of unnecessary interventions, instead of the unknown benefit of the intervention of routine tracheal intubation and suctioning," end quote. See, that's good stuff. The take-home message is, hey, they delivered to the meconium, get that kid out, and even if it's non-vigorous, you don't have to do routine suctioning, whether it's with the bulb or delete, or you're just going to intubate and suction because that's what you do. Don't do that. Only do that if there is suspected airway obstruction. Otherwise, get the baby into the warmer and do your routine neonatal resus that supports ventilation and oxygenation, because routine intubation, routine suctioning, especially blind suctioning, does not help. If they're going to aspirate meconium, they likely did it in utero. Thank you for being part of our podcast family. We really are grateful and thankful that you've chosen to take this journey of medical education with us. You're listening to Clinical Pearls. It's kind of stuff that we take for granted, right? Amnioinfusion, yada yada, has been around forever. No, it really hasn't. Now, I just bear with me. It's going to be like a minute, all right? Because this is cool history. Remember, it's got to start somewhere. Somebody thought, why don't we put fluid up in there and see if these fetal heart rate compressions can get better? Wow. And so this has not been like since the inception of obstetrics. No, it's relatively recent in the history of intrapartum care. This was first studied and first described, guys, 1976. Now, you can look at that like, oh my gosh, that's a long time ago. Yeah, I get that in normal people time, but in medical history time, not long ago. And that was first described using the rhesus monkey model. So it wasn't even in people. Like, hey, I think this is what we're seeing here on the strip. These fetal heart rate D cells, this looks like it's actually from umbilical cord compression. That's where we get the understanding of variable D cells and the ability to rescue that through amnioinfusion. That was Gabby. Guys, that was like in Gabby's Book of Obstetrics, and that was published in 1976 in the Gray Journal. So 1976, out of an animal model, because nobody had actually tried it yet successfully in a person, like we can actually put fluid back into the cervix and try to help the fetal heart rate tracing through Dr. Gabby's work. Incredible stuff. Then in 1983, again in the Gray Journal, this was actually done with a, quote, preliminary report, end quote, where it was actually done intrapartum for people. So is that fascinating or what? Do you think that's always been around? No, it really hasn't. 1976, where Dr. Gabby first did this in an animal model, and then 1983 published, I'm looking at the report right here, in the Gray Journal. The title of that publication was Saline Amnioinfusion for Relief of Variable or Prolonged D Cells, a Preliminary Report. Of course, now we don't do it for prolonged D cells. Its main indication, of course, is the variable D cells that are recurrent, okay, more than 50%. So I just thought that was interesting. Now, whether, if you notice, it said with saline, the most traditional, by expert opinion, just because it seems to be more data on this, is the use of lactate ringer. You can absolutely use saline. There's no problem with that. Just obviously do not use D5, right? Because you don't want stuff to crystallize in there. So don't do D5. So whether it's saline or LR, it really is up to each institution. But by convention, LR seems to win because there's more data on that. And it seems to be a more comprehensive physiologic solution than just normal saline. So LR is preferred, although there's very little hard evidence that LR is significantly better than normal saline. And there's also no data that you have to warm that to body temperature before you put it into the uterus, as long as it's not taken out of a refrigerator where you're going to give the child hypothermia. And as long as it's at ambient room temperature, it's fine to just infuse. And if you're going to try to warm it, don't warm that bag like in a microwave where there'll be pockets of hot fluid, all right? So if you're going to warm it, the expert opinion, and based on safety, is that it should be done using a blood warmer that uniformly heats it, and it should never be beyond just normal body temperature, all right? But you can do that. You don't have to, as long as it's not cold fluid and it's not little pockets of hot fluid like from a microwave. All right, so now that we know the history of this thing, let's get back on track. And I've already stated this, and we all already get it, that amnio infusion is not a known treatment or an adjuvant treatment for chorioamnionitis, okay? I mean, that's not how I train. That's not what ACOG says. ACOG says if you suspect IAI, give them antibiotics. It doesn't say, and also make sure to give 500 mLs of saline or LR infusion up into the uterus to help dilute that. It doesn't say that. That's not a standard practice, all right? Remember that the sine indication is recurrent variable D cells, and then the more controversial one is meconium aspiration prevention, okay? So that's that. But if you go to 2016, out of the Cochrane database of systematic reviews, I'm looking at it right in front of me here, it is amnio infusion for chorioamnionitis. Did you get that title? Amnio infusion for chorioamnionitis, not amnio infusion for variables in the presence of chorioamnionitis. No, amnio for chorioamnionitis. I didn't know this was a thing, right? But here is the objective of the Cochrane review back in 2016. Quote, the objective of this review was to determine the effect of amnio infusion on clinical and subclinical chorioamnionitis, fetal well-being, fetal heart rate characteristics, and perinatal and maternal morbidity and mortality, end quote. Okay. Fine. So this isn't really focusing on the D cell part. It's looking at amnio infusion in patients with suspected chorioamnionitis and then see what happened, both maternal and fetal outcomes. This used a randomized clinical trial meta-analysis of amnio infusion as a treatment group versus no amnio infusion in women with chorioamnionitis. The authors found, quote, compared to no amnio infusion, transcervical amnio infusion had no clear effect on the incidence of postpartum endometritis, nor was there a clear effect in the incidence of neonatal infection. All right, that's pretty good. They also found that the rate of C-section was the same in both groups, and there was no clear difference in the duration of maternal antibiotic treatment. Now, as a side note, even though that was not one of the pre-specified outcomes of the review, they found that giving at least room temperature fluid into the uterus actually helped with temperature reduction. I mean, they did have some reduction in pyrexia. Again, don't use it just for that. You reduce maternal temperature by giving acetaminophen, giving IV fluids, and you give appropriate antibiotics. But it's an interesting side note that they did find a reduction in pyrexia. So the short of it is, even though there was very low quality evidence and there was a lot of gaps in the data, the main take home is it definitely wasn't harmful and there was no increase in the pre-specified main adverse issues. So it was reassuring. All right, everyone, we got to keep moving this along because I don't want this to get too long. And we got to answer this question just quickly and briefly, all right? So I'm going to give you two pieces of publication. One is old and one is much more new, all right? The new one is from 2020 and the old one is from 1998. That tells you how much data we have on this, okay? Because this is really an understudied issue, because think about it. Come on, guys. You have to have a patient intrapartum. Then you have a patient who has IAI, and then you need the patient who develops recurrent variables who qualifies for amnio. Hello? I mean, that's a super niche deal, okay? But if it happens, it's good to know what the data suggests. And so this is why we're doing this. So let me just spoil it for everybody, although please listen to the data I'm about to get into. But here's a spoiler. Yeah, do it for sure. I mean, if the patient has a first diagnosis of suspected IAI and the baby then develops recurrent D cells, assuming, of course, guys, that there's no cord prolapse, assuming, of course, that there's no overt vaginal bleeding, assuming, of course, that the baby's not tachycardic, right? I mean, have some put this in normal context. Baby's non-tachycardic, we're trucking along, we're like, ooh, we got on top of that IAI, we're moving along, and then boom, recurrent variables start. Then amnio infusion absolutely can still be considered. Now, if there is tachycardia and the addition of variables, remember, now that you've got two issues that make it category two, it's still worth a try. Try it. But if it doesn't resolve, especially because persistent fetal tachycardia in and of itself can be an indication for C-section before it goes into high output cardiac failure, use, of course, clinical reasoning, okay? But the question that we raised at the beginning is amnio infusion contraindicated in the presence of IAI? The answer is, even though it's limited, it does not appear to be. The benefit of amnio infusion to reduce variable D cells still wins. One of the publications that first looked at this was in the American Journal of Perinatology. This was a prospective. This was a randomized trial. This is the Padilla paper. Okay, Parilla, the Padilla paper from the American Journal of Perinatology. Now, this gives us some info. The catch is, it's really, really small, because the cohort of patients was 17. Yeah. Hey, we got to start somewhere, but it showed, hey, this was okay. It did not increase the risk of postpartum endometritis, and it seemed to be well tolerated. As we leave 1998 and get to August of 2020, we now get a retrospective study out of Israel. And the title is exactly what the title of our episode is. The title of this study is it safe to perform amnio infusion in the presence of suspected intra-amniotic infection? Well, there you go. It's exactly what we're talking about. Guys, outside of the Padilla paper and this 2020 Israeli paper, plus that Cochrane review, that's what we got. All right. So I get the initial fear that, man, I can't put fluid in there. I mean, she's infected. And if you notice, if you go online, we did a lot of background work on this. All right. There's one institution that says, oh, what is amnio infusion? Well, is this a great way to prevent a C-section based on certain heart rate tracings? It's meant to be patient friendly. Okay. But then it says, if you have an active genital infection, you cannot get this. Now, that's a confusion, okay? Because isn't chorioamnionitis an active genital infection? Kind of, yeah. But what they actually are implying there, if you've got like a history of untreated gonorrhea, untreated chlamydia, if you've got herpes infection, that's a no-go. Does that make sense? That don't do that. That's a different issue. But for intrapartum suspected IAI, in the absence of those conditions, the data show, yeah, this is actually helpful. I mean, from reduction in pyrexia to no increased risk in endometritis in some studies, like the Cochrane review and another publication that said maybe a slight increase in postpartum endometritis, the net benefit is still there, okay? And that's basically what this 2020 publication from Wiley's Journal of Gynecology and Obstetrics found. This was a retrospective study that was done at a tertiary medical center between 2010 and 2019. All right, so that's when the study period where this was examined. Cases where amnio infusion was performed after the diagnosis of suspected IAI were compared to cases without amnio infusion. So it's exactly what we're talking about. The study cohort included 786 patients. And you're thinking, hey, all right, that's pretty good. Yeah, but you got to remember, look how niche this is, right? They're intrapartum. They have to have a pre-existing diagnosis of IAI, and the pre-existing meaning before fetal heart rate abnormality, and then they have to get variable D cells. So the triangle is inverted, and the little point at the bottom is the study pool. So out of 786, 724, in other words, 92, did not have amnio infusion, leaving 8% that were in the amnio infusion group. That was an N of 62. Guys, super niche, all right? So when you first read this, you're like, ooh, 786 patients. Yeah, but the majority of those were in the control. Because again, it doesn't take away the value of this publication, even though it's retrospective. The point is, look at that inverted triangle, right? The big platform at the top of the inverted triangle, the base, is people in labor. Then the next, as you get narrower, is, oh, you got intra-amniotic infection. And then even narrower, oh, you've got recurrent variable D cells. You see how it gets smaller, all right? So this was 8% that were in the treatment group. Nonetheless, quote, the use of amnio infusion for alleviating non-reassuring fetal heart rate in the presence of suspected IAI is safe and does not increase the rate of maternal adverse outcomes, end quote. Now, if you're thinking, well, that's great, maternal outcomes weren't change, but what about the kid? No worries. Neonatal blood gases and Apgar scores, we know how good those are, and Apgar scores did not differ between the groups either. So again, it is reassuring. So we've got these isolated pieces of data. Remember what I said, both as a little teaser in a previous episode and at the beginning of this one, there's not one bulletin that says, here's what we know. You've got to go into the data. You actually have to pull these things out. 1998, Cochrane Review 2016, this publication from Wiley, Gynecology and Obstetrics in 2020. You got to put these together and then look at it with ACOG's Management of Fetal Heart Rate Tracing Abnormalities for Recurrent Variables, where it says amnio infusion. Marry all of those together. Guys, that's what we're trying to do here. Remember the individual puzzle pieces that I always describe what we're trying to do here? Take this little puzzle piece and put it together with this one, add it to this one. And when you step back, you get the entire picture. So what's the entire picture here? That IAI sucks. That IAI is an indication for antibiotics. That IAI can give fetal heart rate abnormalities, mainly tachycardia, which has its own set of issues. But once that resolves in the presence or the development of recurrent variable D cells, amnio infusion can be done as a way to rescue the child without significantly increasing adverse maternal or neonatal outcomes. All right, so what's the take-home message? Yes, amnio infusion is not contraindicated in the presence of treated IAI if the only issue that you're trying to treat here, guys, is those recurrent variable D cells. All right, let's bring it home. All right, podcast family, that brings us to a wrap. As always, we're thankful for you, and we're glad you're part of our podcast community. We'll see you on another episode of Clinical Pearls.